Good evening, folks. This is Radio Edu Talk. It is Wednesday, the 27th of August at 2014. My name's John Johnson. I'm sitting here in Glasgow. I'm joined, as usual, by my co-host, David Noble. Tonight, we're having a double show, and in this section of the show, we've got double guests. I'm really delighted and excited to introduce Amy Collier, I hope my name pronouncing right, who is Director of Digital Learning Initiatives in the University of... which university?
Stanford.
My name, I've been talking about this all afternoon to my colleagues at work and my head just went empty. And we've also got Dr. Jen Ross, who's Digital Education School of Education in Edinburgh University. So
hello.
We're starting at a higher level than often this week. Amy, could you maybe just start and introduce yourself, where you've been, what you do, that sort of thing, and then we'll get on to unbundling.
Certainly. So as you said, my title at Stanford is Director of Digital Learning Initiatives. I've been at Stanford for about 2.5 years. And prior to joining Stanford, I was at a small university in Texas called Texas Wesleyan University. I was the director of their Center for Teaching and Learning. Now at Stanford, in the role of Director of Digital Learning Initiatives, I primarily oversee a part of our unit that does course development, that helps faculty with course development, online course development, blended, and also MOOCs as well. And so I have a team of instructional designers that I directly oversee, and then I coordinate both our operations and strategy around course design and course development across all different parts of our unit, and also work on outreach to faculty, talking about hopefully good ideas for teaching and learning, both digital and not digital, and do outreach to other parts of the university to figure out what are we going to do with digital learning and what makes sense and what's a good way that Stanford can move forward.
Brilliant. Sounds a wonderful, if somewhat challenging, gig. One of the things you mentioned, mm-hmm. just in there, we could just open up a wee bit before we go on, is you mentioned blended.
Yes.
And maybe could you just explain to our listeners what you mean by blended?
Certainly. So the blended education that I was referring to is where there are parts of a learning experience that students might have, maybe in a course, that are that some of those parts happen online and are informed and inform things that would happen face to face. And so there's a component, there are components of the course that are online, components that are face to face, and those, in an ideal situation, actually work very well together, are synergistic and inform and feed each other. An example, some might argue with me that flipped learning is not really blended learning, but some people will take flipped as part of blended learning. And we've had a lot of interest in flipped learning, which is where things that would happen in the classroom typically, traditionally, say lecture and transmission activities, actually now happen online, usually via some kind of video or prior reading that then prepare students to come to class and do hands-on activities and discussions. So that's kind of a form of blended learning. People could obviously argue with me on the semantics of it, but so that's what I meant.
Yeah, that's great. And we've been talking in Scotland recently quite a lot about flipped learning, and it's beginning to make sort of some inroads or toeholds in school education. And that's immediately sprang to mind when you started describing blended, and it's maybe not all of blended but an element of it. Would that be fairer to say than it equals?
That's right. I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you also mentioned the MOOC word, which is probably more sort of in the face of our sort of tertiary level colleagues. And mm-hmm. a MOOC is a massive open online course, yeah, and in Stanford are using it in a particular way. I'm certainly aware myself of you know, different flavours of MOOC and different ways people are doing these things.
Mm-hmm. Right. Stanford has been involved in MOOCs since late 2011, and or mid to late 2011. They preceded Stanford. They began much earlier than that. But the Stanford involvement started in mid to late 2011. We've produced scores of them now. And they range from, you know, a series of lectures on a particular topic and maybe some discussions, interactions, all the way to heavily interactive, team-based MOOCs open to the public that people can take. And most people who do take them for kind of lifelong learning things. I want to learn a little bit more about this topic, or I'm already a professional in this field and I want to hone my skills or my knowledge in a particular area. So those we see a lot of those kinds of uses.
Great, thanks for that. I think that just gives us enough background to swing into the main topic of today, which is the unbundling. So are you okay just to launch into, I guess, an angle of the talk that you were given today?
Sure, absolutely. So by way of a little bit of introduction, I first want to define unbundling, because it's certainly a term that has a lot of definitions, and so I'm going to define it one way. There are certainly other ways that people have defined it and could, again, argue with me on the way that I'm doing it. But essentially, unbundling, in the way I'm looking at it, is the breaking apart of services offered by some kind of industry provider, or the compartmentalization of component pieces of that provider so that it can be delivered more efficiently and or more cheaply by other providers. So you may have seen an example of this with kind of the unbundling of the music industry by iTunes, where they kind of unbundled the record, the album, into component pieces so that people could now begin to download individual songs rather than entire albums. In education, we may think of unbundling as the compartmentalization of services and goods that are typically packaged and provided by an educational institution, something we typically call an education, and allow those compartmentalized pieces to be offered by other organizations, often private companies. So I like what one attendee said today after my talk. He said that unbundling as a word might actually be too amorphous and too broad. He said it might actually leave too much room for all kinds of misdeeds. But in many ways, it's the move towards privatization of education and its various components. And so he said we as educators really should be calling it what it is and lead the naming of what it actually is. So that's something our listeners will discuss amongst themselves. Go ahead.
Sorry. So that for me makes a lot more sense and is something that, to some extent, I'm nervous about. Although in education we use lots of privately and commercially produced materials, we don't drive our ethos or our philosophy or our pedagogy from a supplier or a range of commercial suppliers. Am I on the right track there? And
yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think that certainly we're seeing much. I mean, think about the number of educational technology companies that have emerged in the last few years, and how much investment has been made in these companies. And you know, in some ways, a lot of them are doing exactly that. They're taking a piece of what a university or universities or schools may have originally done themselves or provided, and privatized it, you know, brought it out as a service, maybe offering to make it cheaper or more accessible to learners. And so, you know, the question is, when is that okay? When is that maybe not okay? And what should we be thinking about when we have the opportunity to unbundle parts of the educational experience our students have and what our institutions provide? What are the types of questions we should be asking ourselves as we think about doing that? So, you know, there are various ways in which unbundling has been characterized. And there are various levels of unbundling. So it can be anything from what we might call institutional unbundling, which is where maybe a school or university unbundles the curriculum they once provided for their students, or unbundles who gets to accredit curriculum. It could be unbundling of various roles in institutions, like advising. Maybe advising is now provided by an online service that advises all the online students. The faculty role is one in particular that's been hit by unbundling. We now have institutions where a teacher may be handed a course that's been designed by someone else and told, this, you know, this is what you're going to teach. And that kind of unbundles the course designer role that faculty have long had. So I talked today about how unbundling is not new, but MOOCs and educational technology more broadly, and as I mentioned before, the related educational technology companies that have a lot to gain from it, have really amplified the call for unbundling. So we see examples of universities that now offer credit to their students for taking another university's MOOC. We see policy and strategy groups like the American Council on Education recommending credit for students who participate in and buy identity verification services for various MOOCs. And we see disaster publications like Pearson's The Avalanche is Coming, citing MOOCs and unbundling is the disruptions that will save education. Much like they'll also say that iTunes saved consumers from, you know, the oppressive music industry. Mm-hmm. You know, Clay Shirky, who speaks a lot about these kinds of things, has said, you know, higher education is being disrupted. Our MP3 is the massive open online course. So people are even making that connection. And, you know, I worry about, about just the framing under which unbundling is touted as an opportunity, and what people are saying about education to make unbundling seem like the way to go. I worry about how much it's happening and why it's happening and who wins and who loses in unbundling. I think we need to have more critical discussion about it. So today in my talk, I mentioned kind of three concerns I have about unbundling, and I saw that you tweeted out a link to my slides, so you'll also see this in the slides if people are looking at the slides. So one concern I have is just the who and the what and the how of rebundling. And I cited George Siemens, who's at the University of Texas in Arlington, who recently attended a conference held by Newton, which is a learning analytics company, an adaptive learning company. And he was attending one of their conferences, and he said, you know, people are talking about unbundling, but really the real story is rebundling. And the things that get rebundled, and to George and others, there's a power shift when that happens, when rebundling happens, from universities to whoever's doing the rebundling. And in many cases, it's the for-profit companies. And there's also a concern that I have about kind of with unbundling and rebundling, is there the opportunity, I think there is, to widen gaps between the haves and the have-not. The founder of Newton, the company I was just mentioning, once wrote that the fully bundled experience that, you know, was typically provided by the university or by schools will still be available to those who can afford it. But the unbundled and the rebundled experience rebundled by others will be for the rest of everybody else. And it seems to me that those who would benefit the most from a bundled experience and all the things that are involved in that are the ones who will no longer have access to it. And so I do think I have, you know, concerns about that aspect of unbundling and rebundling. The second concern I have is around the unbundled teacher role that I mentioned a little while earlier. You know, historically, faculty and teachers, their roles have included things like course development and research and advising and mentoring and a whole wealth of activities related to the educational institution. And I worry that we're seeing a chipping away of that role, and with it, a lessening of the commitment from universities to funding full-time faculty who participate in that multifaceted role. And so we're certainly seeing the rise of the adjunct professional, and universities only willing to invest in a small number of full-time faculty who have that multifaceted role. So I cited a dissertation study by Vernon Smith back from 2008, where he showed that institutions that he looked at who were trying to implement online learning adopted one of three faculty models. One of them he called a craft model, which is where the faculty member kind of developed an online learning experience, you know, start to finish. It was entirely their baby in some ways. There was a collegial model where faculty worked together to develop courses and learned from each other and talked through the process. And then there was this kind of virtual assembly line model where faculty were essentially kind of treated as subject matter experts, but then kind of taken out of the entire course development process and then handed something later and said, this is what you're going to teach. And the first, the craft model, you know, was fairly intense for the faculty, but they also reported a lot of satisfaction and pride in their work, while kind of those in the virtual assembly line talked about the loss of feeling of professional power, a destruction of their professional domain. So I certainly think that we need to carefully think about what it means to unbundle the teacher role and what might be lost, both from the perspective of student experience, but then also from the perspective of the professional role of faculty in their professional domain. And then finally, the last thing I mentioned, and this is kind of a squishy, so to speak. It's not very, I haven't put a lot of clear words behind it, but you know, my third concern was just kind of about the art of the university, of the school, of that bundled experience. And the questions I'm struggling with are, you know, what gets lost in unbundling? What synergies? What serendipities, what things are important and possibly transformative about education that we might not notice until they're gone when we've unbundled them and taken them away. In some ways, you know, I was talking to a colleague of mine recently, and we were saying, in some ways, when you think about education, you almost have to think about education as being more than the sum of its parts. And I think that one of the things that we see with unbundling is just believing that education is its parts and that those parts can be done by other organizations. And if you believe that education is more than the sum of its parts, then starting to tear those apart and reconfigure them with other parties in mind, you just really have to kind of consider what are the things that might get lost when you do that.
Great stuff, Amy. It's David Noble here. I'll just say for the benefit of listeners that if you're listening to the live show, there's a link to Amy's slide share from our talk earlier today at Edinburgh University. If you go to twitter.com/edutalker, EDUTALKR, I think it's the third link down. John, you can correct me if I'm wrong there. Of course, at any point during tonight's show or any time after, if you're listening to the podcast, if you want to pose a comment or question to Amy, then you can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or if you just pop the hashtag edutalk into your Twitter comment, then we can pick that up straight away. Jen, can you just take us through the kind of main impressions that you got from listening to Amy earlier on today?
Yeah, thanks, David. I think what was really striking for me, one of the things that was really striking for me, was how much of this discussion was about digital education, but also how much of it wasn't. I don't know if that strikes a chord with you, Amy, but I felt like there was a lot of conversation here that was about the way that education is thought about more broadly than the digital sphere. And I guess for me, I'm wondering now, what is the relationship of the digital and online education to these practices and ideas of unbundling? It doesn't seem to be as straightforward, you know, the digital has caused this. So I wonder what you think is going on there.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I certainly think that in other industries, we've seen, you know, say the digitization of music. Certainly people think about that as being kind of a precursor to the disruption of the music industry, because in order for a company like Apple to be able to unbundle this thing called an album, it first had to be in a format that could be unbundled, and it would probably be difficult to do so if it hadn't already been digital. So I do think that a lot of times when we talk about unbundling, people automatically, in education specifically, people automatically reference digital education, because in some ways what digital education has done has made maybe more visible and more accessible from a, I understand what people are doing when they teach in digital education experiences. And I can see how those things could be maybe parsed out as a piece of the educational experience. And so I think maybe digital education in some ways has made it more transparent that things can be unbundled, and that there's certainly opportunities for privatization of parts of the educational experience. But like I said before in my talk, you know, this certainly had been happening well before digital was a thing, right? So there was a great unbundling, if you will, of what we now refer to as student services back in the late 1800s. And that was where there was a movement to say, maybe there's a whole realm of services that currently faculty provide around support of students in the future, you know, career and mentoring and advising that could be done by other professionals. And that led to an unbundling of those jobs from many faculty roles, not all faculty roles. And that had nothing to do with digital education. That had everything to do with, actually, I don't know entirely what the genesis of that was. So I do think that there's a lot that isn't related to digital education, maybe more related to people's perceptions of the value of education, broadly speaking, and the costs associated. As we've seen in the U.S. at least, there's been an increasing shift of cost of education back onto the student and their family. And so students are taking on more and more debt. They are paying in, you know, it's expensive to get an education. And so I think a lot of the pressures that people are feeling around paying for education and what education is then worth to students puts as much pressure on the discussions of unbundling as digital does.
Yeah, I think that really echoes my take on one of my takeaway messages from your talk today. Another thing that I was interested in that you were talking about this afternoon that I wondered if you might say a little bit more about right now was about the vision of education that underpins the idea of unbundling. In other words, what do you kind of have to assume about what education is for unbundling of education to make sense? And unfortunately, obviously, we can't show the images that you were showing, but they are in the slides. And maybe you could just explain a bit about your vision of the vision, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I think I said at the end of my little initial part there that, you know, in some ways people who challenge the notion of unbundling typically view, and I'm speaking kind of maybe in two general terms here, but they kind of typically view education is more than the sum of its parts. And so it has all these component pieces, but then the ways in which those things work together and even things that you might not expect to be important to a student experience as they're learning, things that might be more about growing up and, you know, social emotional development and things that are, you know, maybe not things we love to talk about as related to education. Those things are important and part of what education means and can be viewed as. I think, and the images you're describing, Jen, are when we see the role of education and particularly the role of maybe faculty as being one or two things, right? That you know, it's really just about content, and it's really just about content transmission, A to B or A to, you know, 100,000 in some cases if you're thinking about MOOCs. And I think that, you know, that lends itself to a view that things can be unbundled very easily because, you know, content production or content delivery can be done by creating a video of a lecture and distributing it to hundreds of thousands of people via a MOOC. But that's not necessarily what we would consider to be education. That's unbundled content, but it's not really education. And the things that make education really exciting and transformative are usually not the things that you can necessarily just immediately unbundle. So the images that I showed in my talk were these classic images from artists depicting what they thought the future was going to look like. And these are artists of you know, many decades ago. And they drew pictures of, you know, a teacher dropping books into a grinder with something that looked like a grinder, and students receiving that information from the book straight into their heads via headphones. It's a image that I believe I first saw Audrey Waters' show that I thought was just striking. And the other image is one of these these sad little learners. And I'm probably going to receive some hate tweets about this, but in my head when I see this image, I think, oh, look, they're all doing Khan Academy videos. And they're also, these learners are sitting at their individual tablets and they're completing assessments. And there's a projected image of a teacher in the front of the room who's pointing at a digit, you know, a series of digits, and obviously that's the role of the teacher. And there are these little robots scurrying about, smacking children on the top of the head as they get answers wrong. It's not even because they're misbehaving; it's when they get answers wrong. I think that's the most disturbing thing about that image. So you can certainly see where, when you have a vision of education that is, hey, it's just about getting students to be able to get answers right on a test, then it's really easy to see how things can be unbundled and offered by others.
Yeah.
Amy, it's John Johnson here, and I'm just really loving what you're saying here, and it's striking me that the old Yeats quote about lighting a fire as opposed to filling a bucket. Mm-hmm. Is kind of appropriate here, and I don't think it's the digital may make this possible, but digital also makes possible a bit of personalisation, a bit of contact, which can make an experience bundled rather than unbundled. Yeah, possibly not at the scale. Unless you're bundling in groups and peer teaching and things like that, but here in Scotland, I guess we're in primary and secondary education, moving maybe away from the unbundled back to bundling with our curriculum at the moment, because it's putting more emphasis on teachers making decisions on, you know, formative assessment and things like that, which you can't really, I don't think, do in a sort of assembly line process. So it's really, I think, good for us to hear the dangers of giving away the sort of contact and the serendipity and things like that you're talking about.
I mean, Jen, I certainly could find a handful of Silicon Valley types who would argue with you that you can't do that unbundled. But I actually agree with you that, you know, formative assessment and the things that the types of feedback and interactions you can have with students that shape not just what they know, but what they believe about what they know and what they believe the role of what they're learning has broadly. And those are things that, you know, we all have. Experiences of learning that were shaped not by somebody teaching us something, but the way in which they taught it and the relationship that was built and the modeling that they did. And those are things that are very difficult for, say, an adaptive learning tool that could potentially give me feedback on my quote-unquote knowledge state about a particular topic. It certainly could give me lots and lots of feedback about how well I know integers. But it could help me to figure out how to better know integers. But will it help me to understand the role that math will later play in my life and the ways in which it's played a role and gets the person who's teaching it to me very excited about math? You know, there are certain things that I think are just really hard and maybe really shouldn't be unbundled. Because they are, like I said before, the things that really could be transformative. And I agree with you that's, I'm so glad to hear that's becoming an increasing focus in Scotland.
Well, it's our theory anyway, what we're trying to work towards. And I think it's coming out of maybe a more prescriptive, I mean, I'm seeing unbundled has been very linked to sort of prescriptive learning. Now, maybe it's not necessarily, but, you know,
yeah.
it's, and again, it's hard for me to translate what I'm thinking into bundled and unbundled, because
right.
some of the things I think about as, you know, unbundling, I was immediately thinking, well, it's quite good to have sort of loose services you can pick up and bring together, mm-hmm. you know, and use different things in different places, which could be seen as unbundling and not having, you know, all your eggs in one basket. But it needs, and again, this is personal, it needs a teacher around who's monitoring and encouraging and things like that. And before I, I'm obviously rambling here, but before I finish rambling, the question is kind of around that. Can we use a series of unbundled resources without losing a teacher's interest, passion, control, which will give us a richer sort of learning for our pupils?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, and I certainly don't want anyone to take away from this talk and or my talk earlier, because I certainly can be very kind of sarcastic and maybe a little pointy about some of these things. But I certainly don't want people to walk away thinking, oh, all unbundling is bad. Bundled experience is the only way to go. And, you know, let's just move on. And I certainly think that part of the reason why I don't want people to run away with that perspective is, one, I think the word unbundling can be problematic. And so it can maybe mean too much or maybe mean too little. And so what I think we need to talk about instead, and this is kind of the point I tried to make at the end of my talk today, was that we really just need to spend time unpacking what we assume about education and what we believe the role of education is in people's lives, what the role of the teacher is in people's lives, and really try to better understand what are the ways in which we can continually improve learning experiences for more and more learners, so that people have increased opportunities at great things that come out of an education. And so on the back to kind of your talk, your point about the unbundled learning resources, and you and I before the show were chatting a bit about DS106 and these initiatives that kind of, you know, some people could say unbundle courses and students from the learning management system, which tends to be this kind of closed or content management system, kind of closed space where students will be expected to do online courses and assessments and activities. And a lot of initiatives have been about getting students out of those spaces and kind of giving the students the power to assemble their learning experiences via a selection of tools that they use, say WordPress environments and Flickr, and, you know, a series of tools that help them to kind of assemble their experience of what they're learning. And, you know, while you could say that is, you know, in some ways unbundling, it's also a very, I've never seen one of those learning environments not be very engaged with by the people teaching those courses. It's not like we say to students, okay, go out and, you know, throw up a blog and blog about your things you're learning and I'll see you later. I think, you know, these are actually very sometimes very curated environments, sometimes very synergistic, as we were talking about before. And so those can be actually really interesting opportunities to get students talking to each other, talking to people outside of the university, talking to professors, maybe from a variety of disciplines. So, you know, maybe unbundling isn't always the greatest word to think about. Maybe it's, you know, redesigning or rethinking or reframing what a course is or where a course takes place or how students engage with and interact with what they're learning.
And I think that's kind of helped answer a wee question that came in on Twitter. Somebody saying that from a Scottish point of view, that bundling is not a word we use very often here. and want to be used. But I think we've probably unpicked that we've got to the heart of it, and I think there's something in the it's a sort of secret sauce of a good online course is the personalities or the personal involvement of the instructors, which is the same, I think, as in a live classroom. Is that a teacher sitting behind a desk reading the paper, as happened often in my school career, is not engaging and, you know, being active and moving around the class and questioning and all the rest of it. And that can happen online and offline. Mm-hmm. But I wonder what that says about MOOCs, because you couldn't, as an instructor, without running yourself into an early grave, engage with 1,000 people.
Right, and I don't think that most MOOCs have engaged with that number of people as one of their primary goals.
Yeah,
I mean, I certainly think, and maybe it's just, you know, I certainly think that a lot of institutions that are providing MOOCs are trying to maybe replicate, or, you know, kind of replicate a piece of what an actual course at that university is like. But I think in many cases, universities see MOOCs as almost like a digital textbook, right? That it's a series of learning resources now available in an assembled format, you know, curated and created by a faculty member from that institution, that can be used by self-motivated learners to amplify learning experiences that they were pursuing. And so I think there are very few instances of at least the large-scale MOOCs, what we call ex-MOOCs, that are really aimed at engaging large numbers of people, and where you've seen that approach, where it's been more about engaging, it's been more, and I don't typically like this distinction, but it's useful in many cases, these CMOOCs, these connectivist MOOCs, that tend to be smaller, but more focused on having people network and learn from each other and connect, not just within the confines of this thing called a course.
Right, so maybe we could see a sort of ideal sort of elite university style of, you know, a very low number of lectures, but quite a lot of sort of Socratic chats between faculty and learners. And then we've got the sort of more standard university that most people are familiar with, where a lot of lectures followed by some smaller workshops, maybe led by a teaching assistant or a PhD student or something like that, and moving away from, you know, down the line, then we've got a sort of fully automated MOOC lecture where you watch a video and answer a set of questions. And maybe it's not that one form is the only one we can use, but some of them for some kinds of learning and some learning experiences, we need different ones.
Right, and you know, it's interesting to talk about MOOCs as this monolithic thing, because you're exactly right. There are certainly various ways that they are taught and assembled and created, and there are various levels of faculty involvement in that. But I think the more interesting kind of distinguishing factor is, what's the goal of the university providing that MOOC? And that will often shape, in addition to other things, what that MOOC ends up looking like and feeling like and aiming to do. So if it's about, if the goal of the MOOC or the university who's providing these MOOCs is to continue to establish its expertise and leadership in particular fields, then they might be more like a series of lectures on a topic with some opportunities for students to check their understanding. If it's to get learners around the globe interested in participating in a future program at that university, it might look very different. So I do think that the goals of the institution providing the MOOCs certainly shaped that.
Thanks.
Amy, it occurs to me that probably quite a few of the people listening just now or later on will be in the same kind of position that I'm in. And as a teacher and someone really interested in technology, I wonder what you think that teachers and other learning technologists and people who are engaged sort of on the ground, if you like, of education should be doing to try to shift the terms of this discussion or to get involved in this discussion more, this discussion that seems often to happen kind of outside and be, or above or beyond our sphere of influence.
That's a great question. I certainly would love to see if Twitter would light up right now with some ideas that the listeners are having. Mostly because I have a little bit of a different role at my university than you do, Jen, and many of the people who are listening, that I am not a teacher right now. And so I have a little different role to play in that discussion. But I guess what I would recommend to those who are listening to this and saying, well, okay, so this is interesting, what do I do about it? I certainly think that people who are interested in raising this as an issue more broadly in education and investigating it, studying it, understanding what are the impacts of it. We had a lovely woman in the session today who is looking to study this with colleagues kind of more from an economic and policy lens, both the role of unbundling and how unbundling has come about as a result of policies in different countries. Certainly would be great to have kind of communities of people who are interested in this topic and investigating it, being able to have a way to come together and study it and ask these questions and actually investigate the answers to it. Similar to as you and I, Jen, did when we just through a kind of a personal conversation ended up kind of wanting to understand mess and complexity in learning and then going in to actually study it. I feel like a lot of people who are listening, I hope, will say, you know what, this is really interesting. I want to study it and understand it and shape the discussion about it. I would welcome people doing that and responding in that way. I certainly think that at your institutions, when you hear about things being unbundled or in the process of being unbundled, or if you hear at your schools, you know, that we're going to be trying something out, not that I think we should be squashing all opportunities for innovation, because I certainly don't want that. But I do think that there should be people who, if they're, maybe they're not in the room, but who can go to the people who are in the room and say, you know, let's also ask these questions, right? Let's make sure when we do this that we're going into this asking the right kinds of questions and finding out. For instance, one of the concerns I pointed out in the talk when I was mentioning the rebundling piece of it is that when you unbundle and when you allow, say, a private company, a for-profit company, to rebundle something that your university had either been doing or that your learners at your institution are now doing through this private company, there need to be questions asked about the student data, the learner data. What now does it mean? Say, let's go back to my example about there are companies now that will do advising for all your online learners for you, so that none of your advisors on your campus actually need to deal with the online learners. It'll all be done by this an external company. And my question is, well, okay, that's one approach. What about the data from those advising interactions with that company? Have we asked sufficiently about how this company is going to treat those data and those learners' privacy and those learners' interactions? You know, certainly things come out in advising that are not always so easy to deal with. And how might a company deal with those things and that data? And so certainly when we are thinking about ways in which things might be unbundled from the university, we have to ask questions about what does this mean for our learners' privacy and data and identity as a both a person and an online identity.
Well, I'm totally up for asking difficult questions. What do you think, John and David?
I think that last one struck a chord for a couple of things. I mean, I think the first one, just about asking questions about what's happening, is always good. But the sort of data protection angle is quite interesting in my sort of current role, trying to roll out sort of national online services. We come up against this data protection and, you know, provisioning children into services and things like that, and retaining information and all the rest of it. And there's a lot of legal protection for kids that's available. And I'm beginning to think, quite often recently I've been thinking, oh, that just makes everything much harder. But when you look at it from the other angle, it sounds a really important place to ask questions. I think we've probably ran a wee bit over our time, so is there anything, Amy, you would like to sort of bring to the table, or Jen, to draw this to a close?
There's a moment of quiet.
I was like sort of dead air. It's great.
Yeah. It's
Jen, how
it's thinking
about you?
Time.
I guess I was kind of struck. We got a quote, a tweet after the session this afternoon. I think in response to something that I'd tweeted that Amy had said, from Michael Berman, who'd said that historic accidents like the 35-minute LP. Become habits, become principles, and it started me thinking about, yes, we have to ask difficult questions of people who are making decisions about things that may result in unbundling in our institutions, but I think we also have to look at our own practices and the accidents of history that we attach ourselves to, and consider, you know, how reasonable it is to be so attached to some of those things. And I think it's the same point you're making, Amy, about redesign, that we do have to be willing to ask difficult questions of our own practices as well, because other people are all too ready to do that for us, you know. And it's probably a good position to be in to be able to ask them as well.
Yes, and I think, you know, Jeff made a good point in the session today about how, you know, in other industries that were disrupted, I have to say it always with kind of a imaginary fanfare in my head, that these other industries that experienced unbundling and disruption, you know, there were always things about that industry or the major providers in that industry that could have been changed, that maybe had opportunities for changing practices to better improve what they were doing for their customers or for new segments of customers. And so maybe the disruption in some ways didn't just happen because suddenly it was possible to change the way things were done, but maybe that there was a need to change some of the things that were being done. And those places and those industries, parts of those industries, just didn't see it or didn't move quickly enough. So I agree with you that certainly what I don't want anyone to take away from this talk is, oh, everything's fine, no change needed, we're good. You know, certainly there are problems of cost and still problems of access and still problems of inequities. And we can't just sit around and say, well, but unbundling certainly isn't going to be the way to go, so let's just move on. I do think we have to really ask those difficult questions of ourselves, as Jen was saying, and find out what we can do that will continue to improve the things that people get from this thing that we call and love called education.
That's brilliant. I think that's a really great point to end. I was going to throw in a bad extension of the MP3 analogy, which would involve throwing out the liner notes from an album with the concept album. You know, it's that, you know, in the unbundling, maybe we can unbundle carefully if we do it with this love and attention, that would go. Amy and Jen, can I just say on behalf of everybody listening now and people listening later, and myself and David, it's sort of thanks very much for coming in. I think it's great for myself as a sort of primary school practitioner to get this different angle, and always delightful. Kind of, I can see parallels and things like that. So personally, I found it a fascinating chat. So can I just say a real big thanks. People listening tomorrow, we're actually back on again. David will be talking to Dr. Laura Colucci-Gray about Is Scotland Going to Feed the World? Which it sounds quite timely, given
sounds promising.
Our native the debates that are going on in Scotland at the moment. There's lots more coming on in EduTalk over the coming weeks, and you can find out all about that on edutalk.cc. Amy will have links, and Jen, to your Twitter accounts and the slides and things with the audio, which we should get up in the next day or two. So I just again say thank you very much, and I'm just going to hang up the broadcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our pleasure. What a treat.